It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 613 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week it's another great doubleheader as I talk with Travis Horseman from Pythia the Last Oracle and Jordan Thomas with The Man from Maybe. Pythia the Last Oracle is a four-issue comic miniseries from Travis Horseman, who has brought us Amiculus, A Secret History, Sugar Creek, and In Noctum. This book, which has a Kickstarter project going on until Friday, November 17 at 11:59 p.m., is described this way. The Pythia, Apollo's Oracle of Delphi, must use her last prophecy to save the world, even if it means killing the god she serves. We talk about how this series came to be, who the various characters are, and what we can expect from Travis in the coming months. Then everything wraps up with my interview with Jordan Thomas, who recently released the debut issue of The Man from Maybe, which is published by Oni Press. It's described this way. This is a two-fisted, 48-page injection of post-apocalyptic postmodernism. Jordan is the scripter and creator of this big pulpy adventure, so we explore how this three-issue miniseries came to be, who the characters are, and what we might expect from it in the coming months. Be sure to let your local comic shop know you want this excellent comics title. I'm sure you're going to enjoy what they both have to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show.
Once, this was the center of the world. Once, Apollon's faithful huddled in their thousands at the feet of his oracle, the Pythia, for the prophecies he breathed into her. Once, but no longer. Delphi is a faded place now. The new religion steals Apollon's strength by the day. I am a shadow of the oracles of old. Still, there is hope.
The course of Travis Horseman's life has been shaped by his love of comics, theater, and classical history. He brought these loves together in his first graphic novel project, Amiculus, A Secret History. Since its successful founding via Kickstarter, he has explored horror and mythology fantasy in his recent and upcoming projects, including Sugar Creek, which I really enjoyed, In Noctum, and now Pythia, The Last Oracle. How you doing, Travis?
I'm doing great, Wayne. How are you?
Very good, very good. As I was mentioning before we started recording, we got to talk about all this. Well, why don't you first of all explain what Pythia is about?
Sure. Well, Pythia is a comic miniseries. Probably every time I talk about it, I end up expanding how many issues it's going to be, probably. Right now we're looking at nine. It's going to be a nine-issue miniseries about the last oracle of Apollo at Delphi and her final prophecy, which this actually did take place in AD 362. It kind of delves into much like Amiculus did, it takes an actual historical event and sort of takes a left turn with it, sort of imagining what could have happened in regard to that event. In this case, just to give some background, in AD 360, the Emperor Julian became the Emperor. The Roman Emperor Julian overthrew the sons of Constantine the Great and tried to restore paganism as the religion of the Roman Empire. And one of the things that he wanted to do as a part of that was to revive the cult of the Pythia. The Pythia had been, for 1,000 years at this point, the most renowned and famous oracle of the ancient world. She was basically the platinum level oracle that you went to see of something of import. And she'd fallen on pretty hard times in recent years, what with Christianity's advent overtaking paganism. And so he went to the oracle and said, "What can I do to revive your cult. And the oracle said, tell the emperor that my house has fallen down, that the Castalian spring is dried up. My voice is silent. And basically saying there is no point in reviving this cult. The god is dead, and so am I. And Julian goes on to make war with Persia, where he and his army is wiped out, and the next emperor reinstates Christianity as the state religion. So Pythia, sorry, long story short, but short story long, more like, Pythia is about, kind of imagines that last oracle, what was behind that prophecy. In this, it imagines her as a young woman who basically her entire cult is on the line. She could revive the god that she serves with a single prophecy. And the prophecy is that Julian has asked her to come and give him a prophecy of victory in this upcoming war with Persia. And she goes into her visions to get the prophecy, and she is visited by several of her past, several past Pythiae, who tells her not only can she not give, she cannot give this to him, that in order to save the world, she has to destroy Julian and Apollo. And it goes from there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, according to what the Kickstarter page says, the young woman's name is Melanipe. Is that how you pronounce that?
It's actually Melanipe.
Melanipe, which, okay.
Yeah, that means dark horse in Greek.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah, and I basically made up the name. A lot of the oracles' names, very few oracles' names actually survived. They don't really list them. There's maybe a handful of them that they list by name. Mm-hmm. But yes, I imagine this young woman just kind of like in over her head. The circumstances in which she is living doesn't suggest that she's living very well, and perhaps that she's not being treated very well. And just kind of imagines like that she's got the weight of this prophecy on her shoulders, and then she's suddenly ripped away into a vision where she's told, under no circumstances can you do this, or it'll mean the end of the world.
So what? We probably learned this in the book, but what does she tell him then? Does he want a prophecy, and she gives him something?
Well, I know this is called major spoilers, but I don't want to go that far into it just yet.
Okay, because you got to read the book. I get that.
Yeah,
that'd be good. I get that because I'm curious because, well, you said that she's kind of mistreated. Who's mistreating her?
Well, when you first see her, she is. When you first see her, she's. You discover that she's basically lying on the floor inside of the temple in the little chamber where she does her oracles. She appears to be sort of half drugged, and the priests come in and they dress her in this gaudy costume, and she is so out of it that they actually have to suspend her from her wrists from the ceiling in order to make it look like she's sitting up. So it suggests that whatever relationship is going on here, this is not a great situation for her already, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we have a drawing of that on the Kickstarter page.
Yes. Yes.
So that's if somebody wants to see what that, it's odd enough. It almost looks like a crucifixion, the way that it is. It's so interesting about that. But so she obviously has a gift of visions and stuff like that. Is that passed down from generation to generation, or is it just that they, when they find somebody that has a gift, they put it into the group?
Well, the way the Pythia received her oracles was, at least according to some sources, through a vapor that actually seeped up through the floor of the temple, like a gas that she would breathe it in. It was the it was called the pneuma. It was the breath of the earth. And she would breathe it in, and once she had breathed in enough of it, then the god would speak through her and would speak the future through her mouth. I mean, there was training, definitely. The Pythia had to be trained in such a way that she could manage this, because sometimes the oracles were able to handle it. Other times they weren't. There were a fair number of them that actually took one whiff of it and then died in screaming agony. And, wow. You know, it had different effects, and you had to kind of sort of prepare yourself for that, steel yourself for that. Some of them had to have something innate. Some of it, they had to be like prepared for years. That was how the oracles processed their visions.
Wow. But they must have been shown to have the gift, otherwise they wouldn't make them like a Pythia.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I mean, the role was not hereditary. And it wasn't based on your status in society. I mean, some of them were very low class. Some of them, you know, they were from very like peasant backgrounds, but as long as they displayed the gift, then they were deemed as acceptable and, able to be the mouthpiece of the god.
It so interests me that this is a woman doing this. Was she unusual to be the oracle, or did they also have male oracles? How did that go?
Well, what was unusual is that the Pythia was the chief priestess of Apollo, and that was very unusual for a priestess, for there to be a chief priestess of a male god. It usually went in kind like that. And I mean, and in a lot of other situations, not all of them, but oracles could be men and women. Notably, though, there were fewer women than men, at least in Greek culture. But the thing that was really unusual was to have a chief priestess of a male god. That almost never happened.
So how did it happen this time, or is that part of the book?
Well, it is. I'm happy to go into this.
Okay.
One of the things that I delve into is that this is part of the myth of how Apollo ended up taking control of Delphi. This Delphi originally belonged to Gaia, the Earth. And the idea there was that the priestess, the Pythia, was originally a priestess of Gaia. But the mythology has Apollo coming to Delphi and killing Gaia's champion, the Python, which was a gigantic dragon monster, and taking the place over. But for some reason, he retained a priestess as his mouthpiece instead of it becoming a male priest.
See, I find that fascinating, because the culture was largely male dominated.
Mm-hmm.
So to have a woman do that was such an interesting twist. I mean, today we would probably be, you know, cheer that on, but back in that time, I'm sure that was considered very odd.
It was extremely odd. And I mean, I actually delve into that in the book as to why that is.
Okay.
It's a little complicated, but one of the things that I establish is that the Pythiae, the oracles, make it clear that at no point did they ever switch their allegiance from Gaia to Apollo. They've always been loyal to Gaia, and they've been waiting for an opportunity to kill Apollo.
I'm just sort of curious, because how do you kill a god? That kind of intrigues me.
You starve him of his faithful. You basically take away all of his supplicants. You know, I mean, that's how you kill a god, is if there's no one raising their voice in prayer to the god, then in, at least in that case, then that kind of, you know, that does it.
And she's aware of that.
Yes. Well, I mean, she's being made aware of that.
Okay. Is this what the other oracles tell her in the visions?
Well, it's one of the things. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot more to it. I mean, there's definitely a long-standing enmity between Gaia and Apollo, but there's more to this than just that feud.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
What's Apollo the god of?
Apollo is the god of several things, but he's primarily the god of light. Mm. Apollo is the god of light and logic and many other things. I think mathematics, among other things. But he's interesting because he's also the god of plagues. Yeah, his arrows cause his arrows when he fires them at people, they cause plagues. So wow. I mean, he's seen as both this young, enlightened, bright and beautiful god, but a god who also delivers terrible wrath and punishment.
That's so interesting, because you want to be on his good side, sounds like.
Very much so, yes.
Now, one of the things that's mentioned on the Kickstarter page is that she gets visited by five of her predecessors.
Mm-hmm.
Do you go into depth as to who they are?
Yes.
Okay.
She's visited, like, the first one who visits her is the very first Pythia, the one who was there when Gaia's gift was discovered and who gave the very first prophecies.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is another one, like the second one is the one who was there when Apollo took Delphi from Gaia, which is a very big deal. And then there's one that comes after that, who was the Pythia at the height, the absolute pinnacle of her fame and power. And then the next one was a Pythia who, after that fame and power had fallen a bit, was one who was basically, you know, for want of a better word, martyred by the Emperor Nero. And then the next one, who is weirdly enough, isn't Greek at all. She's actually a Goth. She's a barbarian. Is Melanipe's immediate predecessor. And we spend a little time. It takes some time to figure out exactly what her story is and how the heck she ended up being there, because it doesn't make any sense until she says what happened, and then it makes complete sense.
Okay, so she's not the first woman then.
Sorry,
Melanipe, the current one.
She's the last.
I knew she was the last one, but I didn't realize there. So, I guess that we have to read the book to know, but I'm curious as to how many of them are men and how many of them are women, or are they all women?
The oracles?
Yeah.
The oracles are all women. All of the Pythiae were women. All of them.
Interesting. See, I find in a male-dominated culture, that must have been a really interesting and probably a coveted role for a woman. You probably desperately wanted to be a Pythia so that you had power.
It was a very high honor, definitely. I mean, they had, at one point, their word could basically swing the fate of a nation.
And yet, on the other hand, she's abused.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I guess the book we have to get to understand why that is. Because I find that such an interesting thing, because if you have somebody that can make or break whole governments and stuff like that, how do you abuse that person?
Well, to be clear, at the point that she was able to do that, that she had that much power, that was hundreds of years before the point that Melanipe is the Pythia. I mean, the Pythia has fallen on some seriously hard times within the last couple hundred years. To the point that the priests were struggling to even find anyone to to be the Oracle. I mean, they were going to some extremely desperate measures, and it sort of gives a sign that the priests themselves have kind of degenerated.
Okay.
The cult is barely holding on, and they're pretty threadbare, and it's nowhere near the edifice that it once was.
Okay, so in other words, the number of followers and stuff have greatly reduced over
yep.
the time. Okay. I'm still puzzled over the fact that they mistreat her.
Yeah.
I guess we have to understand. To understand that, we got to read the book, I would say. But that's such an interesting, I guess, for us in the West, that's a very different way of doing it. If you had somebody that you respected and thought, you know, had such power and stuff, you wouldn't mistreat that person, seems to us. So I find that really puzzling when we talk about that with her. You know, they prop her up and put her arms up and stuff so she looks like she's awake and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Right there is a sign that you're being mistreated.
Well, there's a sense that at this point, all they need is just they're looking to set someone up kind of almost like a puppet. Like, you know, they're so desperate and they need someone that they can control, basically. And, you know, it could be anyone, and they would be, as long as they're able to get out something flattering for the emperor, that'll be good enough. And that will save their skin. You know,
so they don't know that she can actually have visions then.
No, actually they don't.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. That's fascinating. Wow. So she has this power, but they don't know about, oh, wow. See, that could be why they're mistreating her, is because they think she doesn't have any power, and therefore she's just a figurehead.
Yeah, and it kind of suggests that they've lost a lot of faith in the god themselves, but they're just holding on either through inertia or because they think this is going to make them rich.
Wow. So who is Melanie Pei actually? See, obviously, was like a commoner before all this. Do we know where she came from?
That's the thing. Melanipe doesn't remember anything about her life before coming there. She remembers nothing. And part of this, too, is her trying. One of the other things that her predecessors are trying to do, they're leading her through their stories and in order to help her find her way back to her own, to remember who she is.
Wow.
She does not remember how she got there. She doesn't know. She didn't even know her name. She had forgotten her name before one of them spoke it. So she is so separated from who she used to be that they have to help her put herself back together piece by piece.
Wow. Okay. Fascinating. That's really interesting because, you know, like I said, these cultures being male dominated, it's interesting to see the women having such an important part of society and stuff. Mm-hmm. That's really, really fascinating. That just appeals to me so much because, as I often say on this podcast, I've seen men lead characters forever, and you kind of have a quick sense as to what kind of character they're going to be as soon as they show up on a page. But with women, I'm much more baffled. And so I got to read this because I don't understand a lot of the stuff that's going on. Of course, a woman in this, you know, being manipulated maybe is a good way to say it like that. It's so interesting. And yet she has the ability to do lots of things and wield power. So that's going to be really fascinating. That to me is a real interesting.
Thank you. Yeah.
Think about it. Now, I don't want to spoil stuff, but on the other hand, does this mini series conclude with her ending or the cult's ending? And I don't necessarily need to know what that is, but it just seems to me like that kind of is an important part of the story if she's trying to kill the god.
Well, I think that the thing here is, I mean, we already know how history turns out. It's the how that we don't know. And to a certain extent, like, she has to figure out how to avert this catastrophe how to kill a god and, you know, maybe even bring down an emperor. And she has to figure out how she's going to do that among all the other things that she's trying to put back together. So no pressure, right?
Especially for a woman. Yeah, in a society like that, that must have been really difficult for her. And then, of course, she has abilities they don't understand or know about. So she it gives her the ability to kind of I guess you got to read the book.
Yeah,
I'm just wondering if she uses those abilities to, shall we say, manipulate others in return.
Well, it's funny you should mention that. I mean, as they go through kind of like the background of like the story, like each of the Pythii each of the oracles tell their story. It goes through kind of like the whole history of their cult and like how they did. In fact, there is a part where they do talk about how the power was used in a corrupted fashion, how it was used to manipulate and build personal power.
Interesting. No, there's a symbol under the section called the story. Looks like it's her, and she's looking at a symbol with a P in it. Is that the Pythia cult symbol?
That is what you're talking about there. That's a page where Melanipe has actually starting to have her vision, and she kind of, her mind goes walking outside of her body, and a lot of things are showing up almost like symbols. And that symbol, like, you know, she's seeing things, otherworldly things around her. That symbol that you're talking about, that's the Cairo. That's the symbol. That's the ancient Christian symbol for Jesus. And it's basically saying that, like, in that section, it's talking about how the new religion, Christianity, is sapping Apollo's strength by the day. And this is the symbol of that, you know, sort of this big Cairo sitting on a bloody red horizon, almost like a sun that is just, you know, sort of, you know, like its own sun, you know?
Because I always wondered how cultures reacted to the introduction of Christianity, because, you know, sometimes the Roman emperors forced it on people, and other times it kind of seeped in through like grassroots kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. So are we going to see some of that? Some of the reaction of how people react to Christianity?
We are. It's going to be subtle and kind of in the background because, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Christianity is kind of the elephant in the room that people aren't acknowledging throughout this whole thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, its presence is made clear, just sort of like it sort of informing everything that happens.
Fascinating. It's such an interesting story. It's just like, I can see why you wanted to put out a comic about it. Cause wow, it's just it's gripping on so many different levels, so many things going on. So how long have you been working on the script for Pythia?
Well, I mean, I first started toying with the idea back in 2016, right around the time I was finishing up Amiculus. You know, I was thinking about the next project, and this was something that had been sort of buzzing in the back of my brain while I was, wrapping that project up. And it took me a while to actually get to the point where I felt like I was ready to really pursue it. Part of it was because I went through a bit of a Kickstarter slump after Amiculus ended. And I didn't have the best of luck with some of my shorter projects in that vein. And I wanted to, I don't know, I felt like I needed to sort of relearn how to crowdfund a little bit. And I didn't want to risk a big project at that point. So, I mean, I took a few years to really develop it and find an artist that really just brought out like a completely new look, a completely different look from anything I'd done before. By the way, that would be Jesse Robinson, who is absolutely phenomenal. Her work is just stunning.
So how did you and she kind of come in contact with each other?
It was the weirdest thing, actually. She's a local artist here in Columbus, Ohio, and we met at Small Press and Alternative Comics Expo Space in June of 2022. And totally random. I almost didn't go to that show. I was having a lot of issues that aren't germane to right now, but you know, I was on the lookout for a new artist, and I was going around and looking at different people's stuff, and she was there with a printout. She had printed a compilation book of some of her web comics. She does a really great web comic called Roxy. And, you know, we talked, and I bought her book, and I looked at it, and I'm like, and after talking to her and reading, and like, she has a really great sense of humor, a really dry, sort of wonderfully, I don't know, awkward sense of humor. And, you know, I started looking at some of her other stuff on some of her portfolio on Instagram and on her other sites, JKR Illustrations. That's where you would find her. And I was gobsmacked. I mean, just blown away by the range that she had. I mean, on one hand, she was able to do some incredibly she was able to do some like delightfully funny, comic strip art, you know, just really nice, just really funny, stuff like that. And then on the other hand, she did these incredible dramatic, she has these this incredible dramatic portfolio of like, you know, I think the thing that actually convinced me was she had this sketch of a vampire leaning over a victim that just, this is it. I saw that, and like the look of this figure, like her head raised, like shrieking to the sky after, like with blood dripping down her face. I was like, this is the same person who just did this incredibly cute comic. And I'm like, I need to work with her, you know? And it was interesting because she'd never actually done like a long form story, a long form comic like this print comic. And I mean, but she took to it, you know, just incredibly well.
Wow.
And you see the art. I mean, it speaks for itself.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. Anybody who wants to see it, be sure to go to the Kickstarter page, which is Pythia. I guess it's P-Y-T-H-I-A, The Last Oracle. And you can go down the page, and you get to see some of the art. And it's pretty gripping, I do have to say. It's got a little cartoon feel to it. But it's still very serious with lots of action and stuff going. So it's really, you know, very, very strong. I have to say, it really, I'm sure it's going to do a wonderful job of telling the story, because just that one illustration where she's in the chair, I feel so sorry for her.
Yeah.
So well done. It just pulls you right in. So that's just a great thing. So I always get lambasted because I forget to do this sooner. I'm so interested in the story. But this project will only be funded if it reaches its goal by Friday, November 17 at 11:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And people always get on me because I don't do that soon enough. But I'm so fascinated by the book and the writings. And I guess I have so many questions about it that I just it's just amazing to me. It's just really good. So how far into the illustration? Well, first of all, how far into the scripting are you? You said you want to do about 9 issues. How many scripts have you gotten written? How many issues?
Right now, I mean, I have the whole story. I have the whole story outlined. But as far as like completed scripts, I've scripted through issue 4, which is the one we're doing issues 1 through 4. Here in this campaign. Issue 1 actually issue 1 is already available, but we're also going to be doing a compilation, a omnibus of the first 4 issues as its own 120-page book. So,
oh, wow.
Sort of a nice thing for Kickstarter backers.
That's great. Now, one of the things, and of course, I'm always interested in this, you have a chance as a contributor, as a certain pledges, you can have your face drawn in as a non-speaking character with your own character art. That's one of my favorites. I always tell people I got drawn into a comic about a zombie Moby Dick. I'm one of the characters on the ship, and I didn't recognize myself because he drew me without my glasses. Yeah. And I didn't. Yeah, I asked him, I said, where am I? And he pointed me out. Oh, there I am. I got it. So yeah. To this day, I'm always happy because I think many of us comic people want, just if nothing else, if we can't create a comic, we would like to at least be in it.
Yeah.
And you've got it's the Priest of Apollo level. It's $150. Let's see. You've got one. It's been taken as we're recording this. One of them has been taken, but there are 10. So there probably will still be some left, though. There's the Olympian, too. Mm-hmm. You get to be a speaking character for $300. And then, you get to be a Pythia, be drawn into the series as an oracle. That's a little pricey. That's $600.
That's a major role.
Yeah, that's lots of fun. See, that gives people lots of opportunity to do that. Now, obviously, this isn't going to be in the first issue. If you've got the first issue pretty much completed?
Yes.
Okay, so we have future issues, so that'll be good to know. Mm-hmm. So you have an idea.
There's plenty of opportunities in issues 2 through 4, definitely. Plenty of opportunities. Like it says on the page, I got a Q&A where it asked, like, what sort of characters, you know? And it could be anything from soldiers to priests to kings and even gods, you know, that are available.
How much does it cost to be a god?
Well, the gods are non-speaking characters in this, so it would be at that
150.
The Priest of Apollo level, yeah.
Yeah, 150. Okay, so that's a. Of course, gods are all pretty much dead in this thing, so that's why they're down that low. So, have you a good idea what Apollo is supposed to look like already?
Oh, I have a picture of him. If you look on my page, if you scroll down the page with the story, mm-hmm. It's 1, 2, 3. It's the fourth image down. Apollo does not get a very good. Apollo is not a great guy in this. Let's just say that.
Okay, which one is Apollo? Is it the Pythia must do everything she can to stop this from happening?
Yes, he's the character in the center there with the.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not how I used to see an Apollo.
No.
So, okay, well, that's something. Of course, he's got all those Roman people around them and stuff, so that's really interesting.
Yeah,
so it's kind of
the cover almost, I mean, it's really kind of nice. Jesse expressed at one point that she's really interested at some point in doing a horror comic, and I can definitely see the horror impulse in this image, you know.
Yeah, wow. He almost looks vampire like
yeah,
on some levels. That's really interesting. So that's really good. This is a great book, looks like. I can't wait to see this. It's Pythia, the Last Oracle, in parentheses, comic miniseries, issues 1 to 4. I'm sure the other issues will come along later. The subdescription says, the Pythia, Apollo's Oracle of Delphi, must use her last prophecy to save the world, even if it means killing the gods she serves. So see how that all turns out. How's she going to make that happen? I'm just fascinated by that. So it's a really fascinating book. And so, now, I was going to ask you, and I'm fascinated. Where does this fall as far as the Amiculiser story goes?
Well, this takes. I mean, the stories are not connected. I mean, there is no connection between Amiculis and this story. But this takes place about. About 115 years before the events in Amiculus. So this is Amiculus takes place at the very end of the Roman Empire in the West, AD 476. This book takes place in AD 362.
Okay.
So yeah. So I mean they're pretty close to each other as like late Roman historical events, but you know, there's a good bit of daylight between them still.
So this is a prequel?
Oh no, this is not part of the Amiculus story at all. No,
okay.
This is completely unrelated.
But as far as the time goes, it's before Amiculus.
Yeah, about 100 years and change before Amiculus. Yeah.
Okay, interesting. See, I want to know what happens to her. I don't want to know what happens to the cult. All these good things. See, now I'm fascinated. I got to know. So it's just a great concept, and it couldn't be better the timing, because there's so much interest in female characters and women of power and strong women and stuff. So it's kind of interesting to see how she goes through this and what happens to her along the way. It's just perfect.
Yeah, I mean, this has been I'm really excited to get all of this out on paper and in print, you know, and get this. I mean, it's going to take a few years, probably a few campaigns, but so far this one seems to be, knock, knock, you know, it's going pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course the goal is $10,800. And of course, like most good Kickstarters, most of it goes for art completion, which makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. And it's just going to be a fascinating story. I really like it. I hope it blows past all the goal, and it hasn't yet. We're doing this early in the campaign, but hopefully by the time this comes out, you're way beyond that and gone into stretch goals and all kinds of good things.
That's the hope. Thanks. Good thing.
Okay, so this is obviously keeping you busy. Are there other projects you're working on that we should be aware of?
This is occupying most of my headspace right now. But I think that I've also been working on scripts for I may have mentioned this the last time we had an interview. I don't remember if I did, but I've been also scripting out a sequel series to Sugar Creek.
Oh,
I may have mentioned this, Legends of Sugar Creek.
Oh, I don't remember that.
Yeah.
What's that all about?
Well, Sugar Creek basically is, as you know, it's a one-shot horror story that takes place pretty much in a 24-hour span. I mean, it's
I enjoyed. It was great.
Yeah. And the sequel series, actually, it's really more of a prequel series, you know. You got to love these writers who love to do stuff out of order, right? But yeah, this prequel series, I actually, if you look on my website, I actually the first draft of this, I wrote out as a series of blog posts. Like my artist actually compared it to like a creepypasta, but it's called Legends of Sugar Creek. And it's from the point of view of one of the main characters, the guy, Jim Corey, the guy who finds the thing in the creek and then, you know, terrible things happen to him. It starts 2 years before the events of Sugar Creek, with him first learning about this entity and then trying to learn more about it and then realizing what it is and then trying to do everything he can to stop it. And, you know, it's very spooky, and it ends up leading up to the day, like it ends the day before the events in Sugar Creek happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I have to say, because I helped out with an indie comic, and the guy who wrote the comic, he had 100 years of family history before the comic ever started. He had that all mapped out. So in case something was going to happen, he wanted to make sure it was consistent with what he, the whole time thing. So I'm used to people wanting to do prequels or other stories. And of course, Star Wars did that famously and stuff. So this is a well-known tradition, well-trod road to go down. So it sounds like it's going to be great.
I don't know. I feel like, thank you. I feel like that's just kind of a writer thing. You know, it's like when they start with an idea that intrigues them. And with me, it was like, you know, at shows, people would be like, I feel like I want to know more about this. And he was like, I heard that a lot. And I was like, you know what? I'd kind of like to know more about this. I think there's more of this story to tell. And, you know, it just turns out that like when you end the story in a particular place, there's no place to go, but like backwards, if it makes sense, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you mentioned shows. Another thing, are you going to conventions at this point?
Yeah.
I had to skip out. Unfortunately, I really regretted this. I had to skip out on Cincinnati Comic Expo because I ended up coming down with COVID.
Oh.
I mean, that's one of my best shows of the year, and it's a great show. And it really tore me up to miss it. But my next show, my last show of the year is it's a local show in Marietta, the Marietta Monster Mash. It's on October, it's this Saturday, actually, October 21st, and it's in Marietta, Ohio. And, you know, it's kind of a, I feel like it's more of a horror hound type show, but, you know, I've got several horror titles that I think would really fit very nicely there.
Great. Well, unfortunately this podcast posts on Sunday. So, this will be in the past when this posts and stuff, but let's go to social media. People want to follow you on social media and keep up with what you're up to. How do they do that?
Well, my website is amiculusrome.com. That's AmiculusRome.com. I am also on I'm also on Instagram under just Travis Horseman, TravisHorseman. I think I actually post more on Instagram than I do on Facebook anymore. And I just started posting on TikTok because, you know, I'm Gen X, so I'm catching up on things.
Okay.
You know, but that's also, that one is under Amiculus, AmiCulus.
Okay. Are you on like Blue Sky or any of those?
Well, let's see. No, I'm not. You know, and I also have like my Amiculus Books page on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And,
okay. Well, it sounds like good things are going on, and I'm just fascinated. You know, not many writers can make history, which a lot of people think is dull and dry as can be, as interesting as you do, because Amiculus, I was just grabbed. And this one, this even sounds better to me. I'm fascinated by what happens in this story. And I learned so much, not only about the characters, but the culture, because we get to see them in there. I think so. Travis, you're doing wonderful stuff. And again, it's Pythia, The Last Oracle, comic miniseries issues 1-4. And it will only be funded if it reaches its goal by Friday, November 17, 11:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Don't wait until close to that. As soon as you get done listening to this interview, be sure to go to Kickstarter and support it so that Travis here can keep doing the wonderful stuff that you're doing. So keep it up, Travis, and I'm looking forward to seeing more from you in the future.
Well, thank you so much. It's always great to talk to you. Thanks.
Examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
In the dry and dead future that's coming soon, all life belongs to Oppenheimer-obsessed billionaire Harvard Denny and his corporate scavengers from Smile Incorporated, who pillage the wastelands in search of atomic contraband. As the race to acquire crashed spacecraft's cargo begins, our fate will be decided by a masked bandit and the cold iron of his laser rifle. He knows no name, no home, No surrender, only the whispered hush of those in need who dare to call him the man from maybe. I love what this is. The man from maybe sets his sight on the crate of death. I like that. Anyway, then the creator writer of The Man from Maybe is Jordan Thomas. How are you doing, Jordan?
Hey, Wayne. Yeah, I'm good. Thank you. Thanks for having me. How are you doing?
Good. It's good to talk with you. Now, your book is out now, right?
Yeah, it came out yesterday.
Yeah, as we're recording this. Yeah.
Yep.
And there's three issues in it, right?
Yeah, three issues. The first one's double-sized and then normal-sized issues for the two and three.
Okay. So where did the idea for this come from?
So Hunter Goranson, the publisher at Oni Press, he approached me pretty quickly after he took over the role. And he'd actually backed mine and Shaky Kane's comic Weird Work on Kickstarter, which actually then ended up going out through Image Comics. But Hunter was an original backer on the Kickstarter campaign. And he basically got in touch saying he'd love to work with me and Shaky. Did we have any ideas for something? And we're both pretty good on ideas. So we came back to him quite fast with this concept, which I guess me and Shaky had talked about wanting to do something that was a Western. And Shaky already had the design for the Man from Maybe, so the gas mask character with his couple of Smith & Wesson revolvers was already there. And then Shaky tends to think in kind of images, like moments. So he said to me, okay, for the opening, what do you think about a comic where there's something crashes from space in amongst a load of dinosaurs, but then a NASA-style space buggy appears out of the trees and two astronauts get out and go and investigate, and then they take off their helmets and they're also dinosaurs. So that was Shaky's kind of pitch for the opening to a comic. I don't think he had anything more planned than that, but he was like, okay, what if we start from there and see where it goes? And then I brought in using this kind of more of a Western style after that point, and he already had this character design that was pretty cool, so we kind of put the two together, and that's how we ended up with the kind of fun and strange and wild comic that we have now.
Yeah, it's a space Western, and it's a lot of fun, I have to say. I always like something different, and the skies are orange, and when you've got dinosaurs and astronaut outfits, that strikes me as different. Yeah.
Yeah, Shaky loves drawing dinosaurs, so who am I to keep him away from that?
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. Of course, you introduced the whole science fiction element to it, a sci-fi Western kind of thing. And we get to – so talk about who is the man from Maybe? I mean, what can you tell us about that?
So I guess he's quite a traditional Western protagonist in that Clint Eastwood mold of someone with no real past who arrives in a place and – kind of fixes trouble. Like, he hates bullies, he hates seeing the weaker people being preyed upon by the rich and powerful, but he's a bit more chatty than your standard Clint Eastwood lead character from Western, which I wasn't really expecting when I started writing it. Often, like, it sounds a little bit arty, but once I'm really into the story and know the characters, they tend to kind of write themselves, and I found that maybe was a lot more chatty with people than you'd maybe expect of a lead Western character, especially with younger characters. And although we don't really hear anything about his past, I get the impression from the way that he chats with the child characters in the story that he probably had a pretty tough upbringing and likes to make sure that the younger people and the weaker people in society are protected.
Mm-hmm. So is he like an agent for hire kind of setup?
Yeah, they're kind of like a bounty hunter, gun for hire pairing, him and his partner Gopher.
Uh-huh. And they communicate. How do they do that? Because at one point he says to him, "Pipe down, I'm on my way." How do they communicate?
Yes, well, as we're in a kind of future world, they've got some additional technology that you wouldn't have in a traditional Western. So yeah, they're mic'd up with some kind of tech, Gopher has a kind of robotic eye, which would have some kind of microphone speaker system in it that's plugged straight into his brain, and then maybe also has his equipment so that they can stay in touch on the field.
Okay, so this is Earth, a post-apocalyptic Earth, right?
Yeah.
So basically anything goes.
Yeah, when I work with Shaky, like I always tend to know that I'm going to be working with Shaky when I write a script for him in advance. So yeah, I tend to set up things where Shaky can just go wild with creativity. I don't find, like, if you do something, a book with Shaky Kane, for people that are familiar with him, Shaky's work's it's very Kirby inspired, very bright, very kind of bulky characters. And I think kind of setting him in, if you wanted to do like a very kind of indie talking heads type story, like a, I don't know, like a slice of life comic, that wouldn't really suit Shaky's style. So I tend to always put in, like with Weird Work, we were in just a completely alien world. And here we're in a kind of polluted, toxic post-apocalypse Earth where someone can be green, someone can have four arms. Shaky can just kind of go wild and enjoy himself.
Yeah, because there's several guys who have six arms.
Yeah, they're part of the Grip Clan. Yeah.
Who's that?
So they're more of your kind of horrible, vile bandito type characters who, rather than being kind of guns for hire helping people in the situation we find them in the comic, they've just gone into this little town and kidnapped a couple of the more prominent members of the town, demanding some kind of ransom. But they're not famous for actually delivering the people back alive, even after a ransom's paid. So that's why the town brings in the Man from Maybe and Gopher to go out to rescue them.
Why is he called the Man from Maybe? Or is that something we're going to learn in the three issues?
That's a name that Shaky had from the beginning. It's quite a cool title. And more just speaks to, I guess, because you always have the man with no name or characters like this in Westerns. And so you get a couple of, a bit like if you remember in the Dark Knight film where they're talking about like the Joker's origin, and he gives you several different origin stories. With the Man from Maybe, we have a couple of different ideas put forward about rumors they've heard of where he came from. But then they always finish every tale kind of saying maybe on the end, as no one knows for sure. So it's kind of suggestive of the fact that no one really knows where he's from originally or much about his history.
Okay. We've got to talk about Smile Incorporated. Which is, it's good to know that corporations will survive the apocalypse and will continue on.
Yeah, it's going to be cockroaches and corporations, I think.
Yeah, and of course, the head of it all is a guy by the name of Mr. Denny, right?
Yeah, Harvard Denny.
Harvard Denny. And he, at the very first time we see him, he's waking up and he's got a ball on his head or a bowl or something, and there's fluid in it.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting. He looks almost kind of plasticky with the way he's got like a dot on his where his lips are, and he doesn't look completely human. He looks more like a toy or something like that. What's the story with him?
Yeah, so when we meet him in that scene you first mentioned where he's waking up, he's in some kind of healing equipment that he sleeps in, because he's someone that's been like burnt up by the radiation in the air, like maybe as a younger person. You see the different characters, they speak about as the generations have gone on, they've become more immune to the radiation. But Harvard has obviously suffered quite a lot of radiation poisoning, which has made his actual face very burnt and withered and kind of horrifying. So he has to sleep in these special quarters where he's kind of probably not trying to even repair himself, but just keep the damage from getting any worse. And then we see him put on the giant kind of face helmet that you mentioned, which is what he wears when he's in public, which hides his kind of withered real face with this constantly smiling, metallic, kind of visage. So he's a bit like a kind of Elon Musk meets Darth Vader in that way.
Okay. Now, as he gets out of bed and goes out of his bedroom, he's apparently in Area 51, or does he have like parts that have been taken from Area 51?
Yeah, so he's like a kind of an insane collector, a real enthusiast of everything conspiracy related and to do with nuclear power and UFOs. So he'll have had his people out kind of scavenging the planet for any remains of any of that type of stuff, like the skeleton of some huge alien or the remains of Bigfoot or the sign from Area 51. And he kind of keeps them in a huge collection in his home. And so that's why when the eponymous crate from Death lands on the planet with its very high power ratings, which might be able to help him with his search to achieve nuclear energy and nuclear weapons again, which is kind of his absolute obsession, as he believes that he is a descendant of Robert Oppenheimer. He sends his people out to try and collect it as a matter of huge importance to him.
It's a fascinating character, because as he walks by, I can't help but talk about it looks like that trophy room that he has. He's got, it looks like a Sasquatch standing there. And then he's got an alien, like one of those Area 51 aliens, but it's huge. It's a great big one. And a spine is hanging there in an astronaut suit and kind of stuff. So these are all the things that he's collected, looks like.
Yeah. This is his kind of his super collection.
Okay, that mask drives me crazy. It does look like a toy. Was originally that's the way you guys conceived of this character, that he would wear a mask like that?
Yeah, he kind of came to me really fast. He's one of my favorite characters to write in the series and probably in anything else I've written, where, yeah, he is kind of hiding, I guess, in the way that you might say publicly some of these megalomaniac billionaires hide a lot of the awful things that they do behind, whether it's acts of charity or a smiley, friendly, jokey kind of public persona. The helmet that he has to wear is kind of a metaphor for that, where he's actually really this quite kind of damaged, ugly creature who kind of hides behind this very false smile. And yeah, he's just obsessed with anything to do with power, with things that maybe he thinks that an understanding of will bring him some kind of importance as he's trying to kind of maintain a stranglehold on Earth as it is in its current state in the story.
Because he goes into what looks like a committee meeting, maybe a board meeting of some sort, and there's all these people, and nobody seems to notice that he's, or I guess they're used to it, that he's wearing this mask. And in fact, there's an image of the mask behind him and the images of the different people behind the chairs they sit there. And they're all sitting there talking to each other, and nobody seems to notice or care that he's wearing this mask.
Yeah.
And other people don't seem to be wearing it.
He's their boss and he wears that at all times. So none of them would have ever seen him without the mask on. So this is something that they'll be pretty used to, and anyone who deals with him will be used to, as he never kind of leaves that main chamber, or perhaps he has some secret project rooms, which we find later on in the series. But apart from that, he would never go without the big kind of helmet mask head in public. And he's just super fun to write because, like you say, like it's this constant, like unblinking, weird smile. He has the little metallic kind of circle where his voice comes out of. So you're confronted with this person of huge power and importance who could essentially kind of buy and sell anyone in the current world as it stands in the Earth that we're experiencing in The Man from Maybe. But he also, yeah, kind of has this unreadable face that's in some way like a child's toy, but with a very unsettling kind of evil. I guess he looks a little bit like one of those ventriloquist dummies heads that you've maybe remember, like Goosebumps stories and stuff like that. So imagining trying to kind of argue or get an understanding of what this very complex character is thinking at any moment when you actually have no interaction with his real face is probably quite stressful, I imagine, being in a meeting with him.
So that's the thing that I saw, the like blue circle, that's a speaker.
Yeah, that's where his voice comes out.
Wow, because what's interesting is that your artist he communicates things through the tilt of his head.
Yeah.
Like someone's speaking and he's kind of surprised or doesn't say anything and his head tilts. So rather than him actually saying something, the visual communicates what he's thinking. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I think we talked about that kind of preparing the series. I use a lot of panels with him with no dialogue in them. So you're kind of I'm trying to put the reader, the audience, into the position of having to stare down this character who very much knows what he wants and is just waiting for you to break, a bit like a poker player, in that he'll just kind of stare at you and not say anything, and you're confronted with this very unsettling face that he has that's just kind of smiling a dead smile at you. And yeah, imagining if you would be able to stay strong against him or not. But yeah, he communicates a lot by just not saying anything. When he's unhappy, he normally just doesn't speak and waits for the other person to panic and come to the decision that he wants them to come to.
Wow. Okay. So he's a typical boss on many levels.
Yeah. Not to throw any shade at any of the people I worked for in my pre-comic writing corporate days, but yeah, there's definitely some managers and bosses that I've known who had that kind of attitude where they're almost worse when they're not saying anything than when they're kind of actually kind of angry at you.
So the apocalypse has had a lot of effect on people. He's got radiation burns. There's another guy in the room who has like a see-through brain on top of his head and like looks like a metal jaw in place.
Yeah.
And so everybody has been affected, because there's a girl and she's wearing a yellow visor, kind of a Cyclops visor.
Mm-hmm.
And I figure that's how she's being able to see, is through that visor. There's actually a one girl who looks like semi-normal in the bunch, and she's the odd one. Everybody else is is very unique and very something interesting in this. Are you talking about corporate? Because the corporate mentality and the corporate way things go on, because that does remind me a lot of places I've worked.
Yeah, no, there's definitely a lot of reflecting back the. I guess we're in a world where so much damage has been done in the world of the comic, and yet still these people haven't really learned any lessons. They still want to chase power. They're still willing to just roll over the top of people to get what they want. It's never explicitly said in the comic, but maybe some of these unusual kind of physical additions are through necessity, through maybe they've been hurt, or the guy with the kind of the see-through bowl that his brain lives in is like a colonel, like a soldier. So maybe that was in the war, but there's also quite a lot of like using technology for enhancements. Like these guys have a lot of money and power. So if there's something that they can wear that, you know, makes their eyesight incredible or allows them to kind of access technology whilst walking around, then they'd happily kind of plug it into them.
Now, they're talking about the crash of the spaceship in that committee meeting.
Yep.
And we see that in the very early parts of the book. But I don't think that has anything to do with what the man from Maybe is doing. He's dealing with, looks like raiders or something like that. But the corporation is aware of it. So how do the two storylines intersect? How does the man from Maybe end up in conflict with this corporation?
So it all kind of centers around this, what we call the Crate of Death, but this artifact that's fallen down from space that seems at once both incredibly powerful, but also has the ability to infect people and turn them kind of psychotic and murderous, like we see with the dinosaur astronauts at the beginning of the story. But so Harvard Denny and the Smile Inc. Crew are targeting this. But unfortunately, there is a bounty hunter called Winnet Gator, who is technologically amplified. She's got like metal kind of claw-like arms, and she's like a tech genius. And she actually finds it first and begins to kind of escape with it. But when doing so, she takes it away from the dinosaur that we meet at the beginning of the story called Narc, who's been infected by this thing that kind of demands loyalty from the people it infects. So when she steals it away from him, this kind of sends him insane, and he goes after it at the same time that Harvard Denny is after it. And whilst Narc is searching for the Crate of Death, following the trail of ooze that it leaves behind it, he comes across the Man from Maybe and the group of travelers that he's helping escort across the desert after they successfully complete the earlier mission of rescuing the sheriff who'd been kidnapped by the gang we mentioned. And in doing so, some bad things happen, which mean that the Man from Maybe is then on a kind of a mission of revenge against the evil Narc dinosaur, who is pursuing the Crate of Death. So yeah, everyone kind of, Narc is chasing the Crate of Death, Harvard's chasing the Crate of Death, and the Man from Maybe is chasing Narc.
So the world is actually sort of a, it looks like it's largely desert.
Yeah. I think most stuff's been wiped out by radiation. Not much grows anymore. Most of the rivers and seas have dried up. And although, I mean, we're in a specific part of the world, it's not to say that maybe there could be other areas of the world that are different. But yeah, in the part that this story takes place in, it's mostly very much like a Mad Max style kind of desert planet.
Now, at one point, the Man from Maybe takes his mask off, which looks like a breathing kind of a thing. And he's talking with a girl, looks like. The thing I'm curious about is that he takes his mask off. Was it safe for him to do that? Is that why he did it?
Yeah, so they talk a bit in one scene, him and the young girl who's called Glip or Glinda. And they discuss how, like, the different generations who, like, I guess through kind of Darwinism, if you like, each new generation of people born into this kind of toxic world are more and more immune to the radiation and the toxicity. So Glip, although she has had to have replacement robotic legs, she actually doesn't really suffer from radiation poisoning anymore. Like, she says that occasionally she could get sick if she drank some bad water, but apart from that, she's fine. Whereas her parents have to stay in near the purifiers, which kind of purify the radioactivity out of the air. And so maybe when he's out in the particular areas which are especially radioactive, he'll wear his mask. But when he's back in like a town or a city, which is maybe has some of the radioactivity cleaned away, he's safe to take off his mask.
Okay, so that's interesting, because I always wonder when people wear a mask and when they take it off, that's usually a sign that they feel safe. So I was just sort of curious as to him doing that. And of course, if you want to have a conversation too, you might want to take your mask off so that people can hear what you're saying better. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, normally when he has the mask on, it means that there's some kind of something's about to go down.
Okay, and he's got a real horse.
He does, yeah. That's kind of one of the special things about him.
It's kind of rare, apparently, because the girl is asking, is that a real horse? And so, obviously, animals haven't fared well in the post-apocalyptic era.
No, definitely in the areas that they're in, having one that is just a complete purebred horse with no mutations or, you know, they haven't turned bright green or anything like that is super rare.
Wow, okay. So it's very unusual. Now, the first issue it says it's a two-fisted 48-page injection of post-apocalyptic postmodernism. That's a mouthful right there. That's pretty good.
Yeah, but I think that was a surprise from Oni. I don't think I wrote that.
Okay, because there's a lot of action and adventure in this one, with lots of interesting things going on. So 48 pages for the first one. Why did you decide to do a bigger first issue?
I think I don't know how many periodical comics you still buy, Wayne, but often when you get the 22-page opening issues of a story, like, you don't always feel like you've gotten that much for your money. You know, there's a lot of setup. There's before you actually get into the story, you're introducing the characters. So you don't always, I think, finish a standard 22-page issue or 20 pages if it's Marvel or DC these days, opening issue, and feel like you're really that sure about the story. Like, what's going to happen? Do you like this? And for example, I mean, the first 8 pages of this issue is almost silent in a kind of 2001 A Space Odyssey style with the dinosaur astronauts investigating the crash site. And you don't actually meet the man from maybe until the 9th page. So if this was a 22-page issue, you'd kind of almost be halfway through. Whereas doing it at 44 pages of story, it's allowed us to really kind of open up the world. And I think by the time you finish reading this issue, you'll have a real good idea of the characters. You're going to know exactly what the story's about. You're going to have also had multiple action scenes. You know, you've got dinosaur astronauts, you've got crazy megalomaniac billionaires with giant Darth Vader smiling puppet helmets. You've met Maybe and Gopher and Angie, their horse, and you've got a real kind of grip on exactly what this is going to be and whether it's going to be the kind of thing that you're into.
Now, you've also got multiple covers. Talk about the different covers and how those came to be.
So on this first issue, we've got obviously Shaky's awesome cover, which is, I think, referring back to this kind of postmodernism. It's very artistic. It's got a bit of an Andy Warhol vibe with the multiple atomic bomb explosions in the background in different colors. And that really sets up the series really beautifully. But then we also got a cover by David Rubin, David Rubin, to give him his proper Spanish pronunciation. He's an incredible Galician artist from the north of Spain. And he's done a lot of Black Hammer stuff. He did a new book recently called The Cosmic Detective with Jeff Lemire and Matt Kint. And he's basically like a rock star in Spain. Spain's full of amazing artists right now. You know, you've got Pepe Larraz, Bruno Redondo, Jorge Fornes, all these guys working for DC and Marvel. But if you actually come to Spain and go to signings in comic shops, then David Rubin is always like, he's the guy, like he's like a rock star. And he did a beautiful, very, it kind of feels a bit like a 70s movie poster for a Western with these kind of concentric circles, which I absolutely adore. And he's a friend of mine. So I asked him to come on board and do us a cover, which was great. And then we also have Nick Cagnetti, who is the writer and artist creator behind Pink Lemonade, the Oni Press series from a few months ago. And he's kind of part of the Oni Press family. We were both in the Xeno anthology book together. Nick's a great young artist with kind of similar style to Shaky and Michael Red and people like that. And then we also have the quite cool Shaky Kane design cover variants, which are a bit rarer, which is Shaky, obviously. He did some designs for the dinosaurs and different characters and Oni have repurposed those into some quite cool covers that are like look like they're on kind of, you know, your old math graph paper that they're like sketched onto. So those are pretty fun. And if you see one of those, they're quite rare. So they could be worth grabbing.
Do you remember how many character designs he has on the covers?
So on this first one, I believe it's just the Dino Astronauts, but each issue has a new one of these. And I think there's one with the man from Maybe, and then maybe one with Harvard Denny as well for some of his designs for that character.
Now, it also lists there are full art variants.
I think that's just where they take off the, if you don't want all the logo and stuff getting in the way of a beautiful piece of art, then those are the ones for you. That's kind of just the art with nothing covering it up.
Yeah, they're kind of rare. There's 1 in 15 for the David Rubin, and then there's 1 in 20 for the Nick Cagnetti one. So those are kind of rare, I imagine. You have to buy several to get those. So the first one is out in October. Does that mean that the next two issues are going to be out monthly?
Yeah. So November and December, you'll get issues 2 and 3. Shaky's already finished issue 2. And issue 3, Shaky's done like the first kind of 10 pages already. So, yeah, they'll be out on a monthly schedule.
Oh, great. That's good to see. I always like it when comics come out on a regular schedule. I mean, I don't care if it's bi-monthly or what, but as long as it comes out on time, I think that's always a great thing that not everybody does these days. So I'm always happy to see that. So, okay, so The Man from Maybe is going to be 3 issues. Is this going to wrap up the entire story with The Man from Maybe, or do you have other Maybe stories that you could be doing after this one gets done?
It's going to wrap up the story with the creative death. But yeah, apart from that, I think it's going to leave some other opportunities open for some potential sequels once you get to the kind of very all-action ending that we have planned.
Oh, all-action ending. In other words, well, you talk about two-fisted 48 pages. So I guess it's all going to end with a fight or a battle or what?
Yeah, yeah. It ends in a pretty explosive, all the characters kind of coming together. It's probably the most like fun and action-packed and pure comics story I've ever written. So yeah, I think people will enjoy it, and it's a lot of fun.
Okay, now previously you worked on Weird Work, Zeno, and Frank at Home on the Farm that I know of. Are you still working on any of those books, or are those kind of wrapped up?
So Frank at Home on the Farm, if anyone's read it, very much wraps up at the end. It would be quite hard to pull a sequel out of that. It would maybe be a bit like how they talk about doing a sequel to Gladiator. And it's a bit like, well, everyone kind of died at the end of that, so I don't understand. But yeah, it would be something like that where we'd have to revive everybody. But Weird Work, I have written about the first 35 pages of a sequel to Weird Work, which me and Shaky will probably get to hopefully at some time in the next kind of 2 years, which will be cool. I think that's pushing things even kind of a bit stranger than what we did in the original story, which was a kind of psychedelic sci-fi noir story with all the kind of the trappings of a traditional detective story, but with some very kind of bizarre elements kind of tossed in. So yeah, there should definitely be some more Weird Work. And so, you know, that was just a anthology at Only Press where me and Shaky did a 10-page story for just one of those issues. So I think that one's all wrapped up as well.
So Weird Work is at Oni as well?
No, Weird Work was with Image. So the final issue of Weird Work came out the Wednesday before. So, yeah, that was four issues that got published through Image Comics over the last 4 months.
Okay. Why don't you describe what Weird Work is about?
So Weird Work is kind of like LA Confidential meets Futurama. So you have a triple homicide, a billionaire's assistant, a cult leader, and the protagonist of the story, who's a detective, his former partner are all found dead in a warehouse. And it seems to tie in with a weird new drug that's taking over the streets of Stella City, where the story takes place, as well as some police corruption, maybe some government corruption. There's a big crime, a big gang war going on at the same time as the former kind of head of crime in the city is in prison. So everyone's kind of fighting to try and be the new head. And in amongst all of that, Detective Ovra Sauce and his new partner, Donald Truster, they have to try and solve this very complex triple homicide, which in this world, so it's kind of like an alien world. Like no one's like just completely human. It's all very like big rock characters and lizards and multicolored people and various kind of weird shaped head characters. And they start to kind of feel like maybe they've been put on the case because they don't want it to be solved. Like the idea is that it will kind of go, it will just become a cold case that everyone tries to forget about eventually, but they're setting out to make sure that they do solve the mystery. So yeah, it's kind of a classic murder mystery detective story, but with a very bright and colorful alien world.
Okay. Well, that's a lot to keep you busy, but are there other projects you're working on we should be aware of?
Yeah, I do have a couple more projects, but currently they haven't been announced. So there's a very exciting one that should be announced in the next couple of months, which I do with one of my best friends since we were about 11 years old. One is one to definitely keep an eye out from. And I'm also in talks with a couple of other publishers about some potential future projects. So yeah, I think hopefully I should be keeping busy over the next kind of year and a half or so.
Okay, so to find out when these things come out, are you on social media and how do we follow you on that?
Yeah, on Twitter, I am Jordan_J_Thomas. And on Instagram, I am ampersand. So that's like the and symbol, you know, AMPERSAND, 1988.
Okay, are you doing conventions yet or are you still kind of staying away from those at this point?
I just got back from New York Comic Con, so that was pretty intense, and why my voice is starting to give out a little bit after 4 days of talking nonstop and shouting over people in bars and things like that. But yeah, that was loads of fun, and I'm going to be at Fort Bubble in the north of England, which is one of the biggest comic book conventions in the UK.
Okay, so I didn't get to New York, even though I really desperately wanted to. What did you think of New York? How was it?
So the convention itself was amazing. So I'm English, but I live in Spain. And it was my first time being in New York. So it's a pretty overwhelming city. And then you get into the convention, and that's pretty insane as well. But it was amazing to get to just walk around and talk to different creators that I love. I had a few friends there with tables, but I just got the pro pass and I was on the only press panel. But apart from that, and a few meetings with some of my editors and publishers, I was pretty free to just wander about and meet people, go to some of the other panels. I'm a big Rick Remender fan, and all the amazing artists that he works with, like Matteo Scalera and Greg Torhini. So I got to go and watch their giant generator panel, which was really cool. And yeah, just get to meet people like Mark Russell, who I'd spoken to a bit online, but we had a couple of really good, like 20-minute long conversations. And yeah, just kind of it leaves you feeling that most people in comics are pretty cool. You know, it's a pretty nice, welcoming group of people. Yeah.
That's one of the best reasons to go to cons is to make connections. And I've several of the cons I've been to, of course, I'm always looking for people to talk with on the podcast, but I've also ran into other people and it's just amazing how comic creators support each other and work with each other and things. So I'm glad to hear that New York was a good experience for you, because I miss going, believe me. Every day I woke up and go, I should be in New York. I'm glad you got to go.
Yeah, no, it was brilliant fun. But now I am falling apart. So, yeah, okay, I need a few days of good rest, I think.
New York does that, I hate to tell you, but it's a good way to be exhausted, though, so that's pretty good. Well, Jordan, you're doing wonderful stuff, and I strongly encourage people to get out and get The Man from Maybe, number one. If your shop is out of it, you can check and ask them to get a hold of Oni, and maybe they can order more copies for you, and hopefully they'll be, even when the other issues come out, you'll be able to go. Probably too soon to ask this, but do you think they're going to collect all these issues?
I would assume so. I mean, it's pretty standard across the industry now to collect these things up in a trade.
Okay, well, it sounds like it's going to be lots of fun. Dinosaurs and astronaut outfits. That was the part that I went, wait a second, what is going on here? So it's a really good book. I strongly encourage people to read it. And Jordan, keep up the wonderful stuff. We'll have to talk again in the future when you have more projects coming out.
Brilliant. Thanks a lot, Wayne. It's been fun.
And that's it for this week. Be back next time. We'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.